Good evening. The final states are called for Biden. Attacks on the left wing of the Democratic Party. Are they sour grapes by untenable candidates? A champion of African democracy dies of COVID. And the U.S. military, the world's worst polluter. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Friday, November 13th, 2020. And as we go to air, Trump supporters have faced off against counter demonstrators during a rally outside the White House, coming amid fears demonstrations may descend into violence during the coming weekend. Fans of the 45th president were making their way down Black Lives Matter Plaza in Washington, D.C. on Friday afternoon when they came up against crowds of left-wing activists brandishing signs ridiculing the commander-in-chief over his election loss. Many of Trump's supporters are in the Capitol for the planned Million MAGA March set to take place on Saturday. Trump has hailed the Saturday protest as heartwarming. And President-elect Joe Biden solidified his victory over President Donald Trump on Friday after the states of Georgia and North Carolina went his way. Edison Research made the call. The final electoral vote tally stands at 306 for Biden to 232 for Trump, an almost exact reversal of the 2016 count of 227 electoral votes for Hillary Clinton and 304 for Trump. If the totals remain the same, despite challenges by the Trump campaign, four states will have flipped into the Democrats' column: Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Arizona, and make that five, and Georgia, while Iowa, Ohio, and Florida, key Obama states, stayed Republican. The most recent popular vote counts shows Biden ahead of Trump by 5.3 million votes. In 2016, Clinton got 2.9 million votes more than Trump. Biden's share of the popular vote at 50.8% is slightly higher than Ronald Reagan's share of the vote in 1980 when he defeated Jimmy Carter. Trump has refused to concede to Biden, gumming up the transition while seeding doubts about the election's validity. A Michigan state court rejected on Friday a request by Trump to block the certification of votes in heavily Democratic Detroit. Meanwhile, supporters continue to hold out hope the vote will be overturned and Trump returned to office. Right-wing agitator Owen Schroyer led a Stop the Steal protest last night in Richmond, Virginia.
Don't believe it!
Stop the steal! Stop the steal!
USA! USA! USA!
And in fact, he doesn't even have enough electoral votes to claim that he was ever the president-elect. But we're about to overturn Michigan, we're about to overturn Wisconsin, we're about to overturn Pennsylvania, and you're going to find out real quick, the only reasons they're still counting in Georgia and Arizona and Nevada is because Trump's still in the lead.
The Stop the Steal protests occurring across the country come as the agency responsible for helping states secure the voting process declared the election was the most secure in American history, and there is no evidence any voting systems were compromised. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi echoed the sentiment today.
And now they're trying to distract and divide the country as they refuse to accept the election results. The election is over. Joe Biden is the president-elect. Elected with a mandate of over 78 million votes. But don't take it from me. The Elections Infrastructure Government Coordinating Council and the Election Infrastructure Sector Coordinating Executive Committees said in their joint statement, this November 3rd election was the most secure in American history. There is no evidence that any voting system deleted or lost votes, changed votes, or was in any way compromised. It went on to say, while we know there are many unfounded claims and opportunities for misinformation and the process of our elections, we can assure you that we have the utmost confidence in the security and integrity of our elections, and you should too. The Republicans shamefully pretending otherwise are doing serious damage to our American democracy here and as it is viewed throughout the world, and making it even harder to address the massive health and economic crises facing America right now. The longer the Republicans keep up the charade, the further out of control the COVID crisis will spiral and more in danger Americans will be. I urge our Republicans to accept the facts, acknowledge the crisis, and immediately come to the table to work on COVID relief.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi. Postmortems continue over an election seen by many Democrats as a disappointment, despite the apparent presidential victory of Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. The Democrats have yet to seize control over the Senate, with key runoffs in Georgia scheduled for January, and the GOP seizing back many seats in the House it lost in 2018. The recriminations have been hot and heavy, with the Washington Post taking the lead in criticizing the Democrats' left wing for allowing opponents to saddle mainstream Democrats, mainstream candidates with shibboleths like socialism, the Green New Deal, and defunding the police. But the senior analyst for Fair Election Focus 2020, Julie Holler, says the attacks being amplified by the Post are coming from a few candidates in the party's right wing.
Many of them are representatives who fought very tight races. Some of them are the ones who won in 2018 midterms. The Democrats picked up a bunch of seats in the House, a lot of them in these districts that had voted for Trump in 2016. Difficult seats to hold, and not all of them held. A lot of the Democrats holding these kinds of seats were saying, well, you know, before they even necessarily knew whether they themselves had won or lost, but it was clear that the Democrats in general had not performed according to expectations. They started immediately accusing the left of the party of bringing them down. Talk about socialism, the embrace of the term socialism, the label socialism, or talking about Medicare for all, talking about the Green New Deal, and speaking out against fracking, defund the police. They're pointing to all of these things and saying it was these ideas that were embraced by the left wing of the party that brought down the Democrats as a whole.
Is that accurate?
The left immediately pushed back and said, look, there's a lot to look at here in terms of why the Democrats underperformed, at least according to the polling expectation. If you just look at the general popularity of these sorts of issues, it's not a strong case. Even socialism amongst Democrats is not a dirty word. In fact, polls find that a majority of Democrats do actually embrace the term socialism. In the media write-up of this dust up within the Democratic Party, what you find is that there's actually no attempt to evaluate whether these claims are based in any sort of truth or not, because, of course, when you do start to evaluate that, you see that they're not. That kind of undermines the whole argument that the centrists have. But in the Washington Post, for instance, the reporters writing about this quoted or paraphrased 16 sources supporting the centrist perspective that it was the fault of the left. Actually, they didn't even interview four progressives. They quoted progressives four times, two of which were the same person, and one of whom they sought out who had expressed some contrary views earlier about the progressive position, and so it was sort of a what you might call a lukewarm progressive anyway. So there's really one person that they interviewed for the story who took a strong position in support of the left-wing position. In the Post, you just have this avalanche of centrist views drowning out the left-wing views, and no attempt whatsoever to try to evaluate the claims on either side, really.
Isn't that to be expected, since most of the media, like the Washington Post, are controlled by corporate establishments? And in fact, the Washington Post has been owned for generations by people in the top levels of American society.
It isn't surprising. What we find at FAIR, we've done studies over and over, and just by reading these top papers consistently, you see that it's very clear that their Rolodexes are stacked. The sources that they turn to repeatedly are the establishment party sources, so the people that they're most comfortable talking to, the people that maybe respond to their calls the quickest, who knows what it is. But in these articles in places like the Post, like the Times, in the National Beltway Press, you just get a real preponderance of center and right-leaning sources. You just don't hear from the left nearly as much.
Considering all the effort we put into it, how small our reach is.
Oh, of course. I mean, and it's an uphill battle because all of the money is behind the sources, the media outlets that are going to present a more corporate-friendly story. That's inevitable. So it's always going to be an uphill battle. And that's why it's so important to support independent media outlets that don't take corporate money, that will give you a more honest accounting, trying to be fair and accurate.
Julia Holler is senior analyst for Fair Election Focus 2020. Meanwhile, in New York, State Attorney General Letitia James called on U.S. Attorney General William Barr, who reversed a 40-year-old Justice Department policy that kept the DOJ from interfering with presidential election results. James joined 22 attorneys general from around the country who voiced their strong objection to Barr's policy reversal, saying it's a last-ditch effort by a lame duck administration to desperately latch onto power. Attorney General James added, "The people have spoken, and Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have been elected president-elect and vice president-elect of the United States." Joining James are the attorneys general of California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Illinois, Iowa, Maine, Maryland, Massachusetts, Michigan, Minnesota, Nevada, New Jersey, New Mexico, Oregon, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, Washington, Wisconsin, and the District of Columbia. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. As the COVID-19 pandemic surges across the country and around the world, elected officials are showing little appetite for imposing lockdowns and large-scale business closing, as seen last spring. But in conservative Utah, crowds gathered at the governor's mansion and private residence, protesting a mandatory mask rule that went into effect Monday. Utah has averaged more than 2,000 new cases daily recently. Nearby Colorado, with 134,000 cases and more than 2,400 deaths, is also grappling with a surge in cases. Exclaiming, "Let's stop this bloodshed," Governor Jared Polis extended the mask mandate there for another 30 days. Meanwhile, in an interview, Dr. Anthony Fauci, the top infectious disease expert in the U.S., says he's had no contact with President-elect Joe Biden's coronavirus transition team and sees no reason to quit Trump's coronavirus task force.
My job as a director of an NIH institute and as a public health official is to focus entirely on what my mission and our goal is, which is to use science and health to preserve the health, the safety, and the welfare of the American people, regardless of what the administration is. I have had the privilege of serving six presidents since I became director of the NIAID in 1984. And that's what we focus on as scientists. I know we're living in a charged political environment, but that's something that is not primary for us. We just continue to do our job.
Fauci went on to say, "The data speaks for itself.
We are in a very, very difficult situation. It's quite problematic. I have said that publicly many times, not to scare people, but to bring a reality check to where we are. If you look at it, we have 10 million infections in the United States, almost 250,000 deaths. We've had 60,000 hospitalizations. And now, last count, we had 143,000 infections in a single day. When I testified before the Congress 4 months ago, I said if we did not get control of this, that we could reach 100,000 infections a day. And people thought I was being hyperbolic. And now look what's happening. That's the bad news. I think the encouraging news that people need to understand, that public health measures, not lockdown of the country, but public health measures that are rather simple and easy to understand, the universal wearing of masks, the physical distancing, the avoiding congregate in crowded places, outdoors better than indoors, washing hands. It sounds simple in the context of this ominous outbreak, but in fact, it can turn it around, and that's what we really need to do.
Dr. Anthony Fauci is the top infectious disease expert in the United States. And COVID-19 has taken the life of another notable world leader. The former ruler of the West African nation of Ghana, Jerry Rawlings, died Thursday from the disease. Rawlings, who was sentenced to death after helping a coup attempt in 1979, broke out of jail, seizing control of the country in 1981 as an anti-corruption populist. He formed a pro-democracy party, the National Democratic Congress, and became a driving force for democracy in Ghana and throughout Africa. He spoke before an Independence Day crowd.
"The great, great big shell. The petrol, the gas oil, the kerosene, big company that produces all these fuels called Shell, is supposed to have held a press conference apologizing for their past misdeeds, what they've done to the Niger Delta. I couldn't believe it. Have any of you seen it? Is it true? For the misdeeds, the evil things they've done to people who live in the Niger Delta and possibly in other parts of the world, I sincerely hope that we will see some more apologies from other corporate organizations like them, and to go beyond apologies, to go beyond reconciliations, and begin to repair some of the damages of the past.
Former president of Ghana, Jerry Rawlings, he died yesterday at the age of 73 from complications of COVID-19. Amnesty International has declared the oil-rich Niger River Delta as one of the most polluted places on Earth. In 1995, environmental activist and writer Ken Sarawiwa was hanged by Nigeria's rulers after a trial widely seen as rigged. Yesterday, two shipwrecks off the coast of Libya caused the death of 100 migrants attempting to reach European shores. There were 47 survivors reported. A mother from Guinea cried over her baby named Joseph, who drowned. Reportedly, human traffickers have taken advantage of civil war in Libya since the 2011 overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, making Libya a corridor for refugees fleeing war and poverty in Africa. And at least 22 people were killed by gunmen who stormed Kabul University before engaging security forces in an hours-long battle on Monday. The attack was eventually stopped when three gunmen were killed by security forces. A regional Islamic State group claimed responsibility. The Taliban denied involvement and condemned the attack shortly after it began. Separately on Monday, a vehicle hit a roadside mine in the country's southern Helmand province, killing at least seven people, most of them women and children. The bloody assault on Kabul University came a week after a devastating attack on an education center in the city, which killed more than 40 young students. Meanwhile, in another sweeping change at the Pentagon on Thursday, an ardent opponent of the U.S. military's presence in Afghanistan, who once called for the use of lethal force against undocumented migrants attempting to enter this country and made a litany of racist comments, has been made a senior advisor to the military. Retired Army Colonel Douglas McGregor will be serving as a senior advisor to the acting Secretary of Defense. CNN says sources in the Pentagon say the changes at the Pentagon may be motivated by Trump's desire to withdraw the last 4,500 U.S. troops in Afghanistan. An author and former captain in the U.S. Army, Eric Edstrom, graduated from West Point in 2007, then deployed to Afghanistan, where he served as an infantry platoon leader. Edstrom was also presidential escort platoon leader during the Obama administration and later became an Army Ranger and served in Army Special Forces. He went on to study climate change at Oxford University. Edstrom says there's no real reason for U.S. troops to be in Afghanistan, adding Trump has been more bluster than reality and claiming to withdraw U.S. troops from there and worldwide.
I think it has to do with sort of attempting to save face. I've developed some great relationships with Afghans over the years, including my Afghan interpreters, some of which who have successfully gotten a special immigrant visa to come to the United States and are living their lives with their families here, and some that were less lucky who served the United States and are still stuck in Afghanistan with their lives still very much in a precarious position. The Afghan people are no different than people anywhere else, and they're looking to live a good life, and perhaps the ways that they define what is the good life is different than the way it is described or defined in the United States. It's a rugged, impoverished country. It's been hard for them for decades. For someone who's in their 20s, all they can possibly remember at this point in time is a U.S.-led occupation of their country. There hasn't been a single day of their life that they haven't lived in a country, and at least any sort of memory of it, where there haven't been foreign forces with OH-58 Kiowa helicopters flying over, or drones, or convoys aiming weapons at them. There's a lot of legitimate grievances in Afghanistan, and the U.S., for being there for 19 years, is showing very clearly that we are in some ways neither good nor great. And what I mean by that is the war on terror has killed sort of 312,000 civilians, which is more than 100 9/11s worth of civilian death, according to Brown University's Watson Institute. And at the same time, we've been unable to beat part-time fighters who moonlight as goat herders and farmers and auto mechanics and merchants, and we've been unable to stop them with the full will and trillions of dollars of American spending.
President Trump, on one hand, he comes into office and dropping the biggest bomb ever developed, he drops on a desert country. You know, in other words, on one hand, he's saying, hit him as hard as we can on the part of that America First sort of ideology of his. And on the other hand, he wants to pull out as soon as he can. And the military is saying, no, don't do that. And I've had talked to a lot of people who say it would be dangerous for the U.S. to pull out. What's going on there?
I don't think that there's any sort of coherent or cohesive strategy from President Trump's mind. And, you know, sometimes I think he's right in the sense that he said it was one of the worst mistakes in American history to go into the greater Middle East. And that was pointing a finger at George W. Bush. But the same way, he escalates drone strikes far in excess of President Obama. And still, 4 years down the road, we're still in these countries. America, according to the Smithsonian Magazine and research done again by Brown University, is either conducting direct action or bombing 14 different countries as of 2019. We still have a huge footprint. But the sort of second part of the question of sort of, well, what happens for America by us not being there? Frankly, I don't think anything bad. The absence of American troops exacerbating terrorism by killing more civilians in the Middle East, getting us out of there at least gives them hopefully a chance to heal. I do not see an issue with taking soldiers out. Certainly putting or keeping us there longer is not going to help the problem, right? I mean, we've been there for 19 years. If $6.4 trillion in 19 years of service is not changing Afghanistan to become increasingly more democratic, perhaps how the United States may want it, I think that the best alternative is to remove soldiers and focus on things that matter, like climate change.
Eric Edstrom, research shows the United States military is one of the largest climate polluters in history, consuming more liquid fuels and emitting more carbon dioxide than most countries. Eric Edstrom says curtailing military spending is one of the most effective ways of reducing carbon emissions into the atmosphere.
It's one of the most gross misuse of assets and spending that America could possibly conceive. Return on investment for military spending is quite a lot lower than other forms of public investment. And that's been cited many times from folks like Joseph Stiglitz, who won the Nobel Prize in economics. If you want to create jobs or if you want to create development and prosperity, don't spend it on the military. Whether you're talking about infrastructure or R&D spending or education or, in this case, climate change mitigation and adaptation, those would be far higher returns that would yield a far better America tomorrow without compromising today. There's different ways to spend. With respect to the question of, do we need to be as large as we are? Do we need to spend nearly $1 trillion per annum for sort of government slush funds for R&D as well as for sort of counterinsurgency operations that aren't approved by Congress and that just sort of bleed on and go across borders and keep going? It's incredibly futile. And I can describe one of the analogies which really hit home when I was in Afghanistan, which is, it's a simple saying, which is, you can't win a war based on terrain denial. And what I mean by that is that even if the United States brought a soldier for every man, woman, and child in Afghanistan to watch them, to make sure that terrorism doesn't happen, right? It still doesn't stop terrorism, which is a tactic, not a group of people, from operating somewhere else. It does not stop someone from getting together in a storage facility in Calgary, Canada, or an apartment in London, or somewhere in Atlanta. It doesn't stop something from happening elsewhere. It's incredibly costly, and it serves no purpose to fight terrorism in that respect. A far greater way of reducing terrorism is to stop killing the people in these countries that have nothing to do with 9/11.
Eric Edstrom is a former Army captain and Special Forces Ranger. He was stationed in Afghanistan. In 2017 alone, the U.S. military bought about 270,000 barrels of oil a day and emitted more than 25 million tons of carbon dioxide by burning those fuels. And that's some of the news for Friday, November 13, 2020. The news is producer Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.